right, here we are, Miss Emma Bates. We're at South by Southwest 2024. There's a lot of programming out there. I love the title, Glitter and Rage.
Yeah.
Right? Does that
resonate
with you?
Behind that. It does kind of resonate. I'm wearing some glittery shoes.
You know, I almost wore some gemstones on my eyes because of a friend of ours out there. But
I'm seeing that more and more, and I'm kind of wanting to do it. So
yeah?
let's start that trend.
Okay. My name is Bonnie Evangelista. I'm with the Chief Digital and AI Office. We met the other night. Tell me a little bit more about you, what you're doing now, and maybe a little bit of where you came from, how you got to where you are.
Yeah, my name is Emma Bates. I am a career think tank, DoD kind of strategy thinker and writer.
Yeah.
I got into modernization and the challenges of modernization strategy and execution and the bureaucracy of it all a couple of years ago through a DIU fellowship. Mm. And I spent time at Army Applications Lab working for Dr. Perley and for then, he's retired since, but three-star General Todd, who really wanted to coordinate their innovation modernization efforts. Essentially, he had various different initiatives, and he wanted somebody who could talk to everyone from the outside, right, to help coordinate those and make sure that they were aligned. And for Dr. Perley, I worked on an analysis of the funding mechanisms that should be available for transitioning from, you know, R&D money to procurement money,
mm-hmm.
because AAL, that's what AAL does. And so they wanted a kind of a deep dive into what are the resources available to them. Since that, I went into the startup world. I founded a startup. It's called Kachai. And the reason I did that is because all throughout my career in looking at, you know, developing concepts and strategies and you know, writing for net assessment on, you know, hedge strategies and things like that, I kept confronting this technical challenge of, hey, we're going to distribute all of our forces and they're going to mass fires and they're going to work together. And it's going to be basically lots of computers working on the same problem at the same time.
Mm.
And yet, that's not a capability that has been developed for, you know, the broad economy or for DoD, as far as I can tell, or for most entities outside of 20 or 30 giant companies that employ hundreds of DevOps engineers and Kubernetes engineers and distributed systems engineers. And so that I was concerned by that as a strategically minded citizen, civilian.
Not a technical, or not highly technical, maybe.
Not being highly technical,
yeah.
Right? But every time I talked to somebody about this, we would get to a point where it was like, well, we don't know why we can't do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why we can't do that. We get three Ys deep and you can't get to five Ys deep because there was sort of this fuzzy layer. And so I decided to spend a good 6 months teaching myself what I needed to know in order to understand what that was and to figure out where in the ecosystem it showed up. Like, what is this bottleneck and why does it take hundreds of engineers to overcome it?
What did you find?
Well, I found that there's a bottleneck and we call it state management throughput. By state, I just mean the reality that a system shares in order to get a lot of computers to work together, right? The common operating picture.
Mm.
That's the state in technical language. And it comes down to an algorithm called consensus, essentially. And you hear about this in the blockchain world, in the crypto world, but it is the same algorithm for all distributed systems, cloud, AI training, automated chip design, track correlation, you know, drone swarming, all of the things where you need multiple computers on the same page at the same time.
To do one task?
To do one task.
Okay.
All together, right? They can't split the task up and then each work on their own pile of puzzle pieces and then put them back together. We're talking about one big task that can't really be split into smaller pieces.
But I need multiple disparate, maybe, systems mm-hmm. working together to do the one task.
Right. Or multiple, even just computers.
Oh, got it.
Because ideally it's one big system.
Got it.
Right. If
yeah.
you have one system, this isn't how everybody would necessarily define system, but I think of a system as a kind of like a body, right? A system's right hand knows what its left hand is doing. Once you have two systems, they don't necessarily each know what their You know, they don't even, you have to find ways to get them to look at each other, see each other, talk to each other, right? Which is fine if there's two, but if there's 1,000, then that becomes the work of a lot of engineers to maintain. So my goal is to enable a system that has its own common operating picture to be as capable as you need it to be, rather than having
without that manual labor.
Right. So that's, and it all comes down to looking at something like, you know, distributed maritime operations and thinking, how are they going to do that, right? you need to have a common operating picture. It doesn't need to be the same picture shown to everybody in that system. They may need to see different things, right? You don't shove all the information at everybody, but everybody needs to be working off the same reality. And that's what really, I think that if you ask me as somebody who, you know, has written for DOD and all of CSIS and everything, I haven't seen any better contender for the center of gravity in future conflict than that capability. Are we on the same page? Can we actually mass fires together? Can we actually get the drones to collaborate, even if there's no human involved? So I care deeply about it. I think that it will be important to ensuring advantage, decision advantage, but also just, you know, overall, I think it'll matter in terms of deterrence and dominance in the future.
Why do you care so much about that? To change careers essentially and go all in on a startup and take it. It's not an easy path, I would say, right?
No, there are very few universes in which I'm a startup founder. Like, it's not something that I started out wanting to do. I spent about 2 years actually, interacting with the inventors behind what Gachai does, figuring out, okay, you know, is it legit? Can we make it a product, right? But also just making sure, okay, I have this set of capabilities that I care about, that I want our guys to have on the ground, in the air, on the sea, and then making them all work together, right? Is that going to help? And if so, then that's the most important thing that I could possibly do for my country, right? They don't need another strategy paper. They need for all the systems to work together in one common operating picture. That's what they really need. And nobody else was bringing that forward. And so
my favorite line was, we don't need another strategy paper.
Right.
I'm gonna steal a line from you. So we were talking off mic and I said, what gives you chills in doing the work you do? And you said, get shit done.
Yeah.
So is this how you're getting at after that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. The ecosystem needs everybody who is in government and working on, you know, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But it also needs the private sector. And I'm realizing, like, you know, there is admiring a problem, right? There is being in a position to direct policy and to advise policy. And then, you know, I had kind of contributed as much as I could there, right? And I saw something that needed to get done. And nobody else was doing it.
Did you take that as your calling?
I think so. I mean, not being a founder, not running a company, but solving a problem.
Right.
Yeah. I've heard that want more, to solve problems.
Yeah, I've heard that similar sentiment about where you saw a space that greatly needed a solution and nobody was solving it. So you took that upon yourself to be the person to figure it out, and how it's played out maybe wasn't your plan, but that's okay.
Yeah.
Tell me about Gachai. Mm-hmm. Does that mean something?
Yeah.
Aside, we'll get into the company specifics, but what is that to you?
So I spent several years in my 20s living in Chile, in Santiago, teaching English at a university to adults that, you know, Spanish speakers, and for a little less than a year in Patagonia, doing kind of tourism, supporting a startup, helping them, just doing management stuff. In Chile, at the end of most sentences, similar to the way that Canadians say "a," you know, Chileans say "cachai," and it doesn't mean anything in any other Spanish speaking country, but it's sort of a play on "cachar," like to catch. Do you get it? You know, right? Right. It's a consensus building verbal tick.
Okay.
That they just, you hear it all the time. And it struck me that it might be, you know, not that it's obvious to everyone, obviously, but it struck me as a good name because what we've gotten at is consensus, maintaining secure, encrypted consensus across lots of computers working on the same problem at the same time. They yeah. need that consensus. That's what the algorithm is colloquially called. The existing one, not, we don't own it. I mean, it's an existing algorithm. And so it was meaningful to me because it reconnected me with a very
that part
happy
of your
part
life.
Of my life.
Yeah.
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 And then every once in a while I run into somebody whose eyes light up and I say, "Are you Chilean?" Because they
you know.
See the name on,
yeah.
on my tag.
That's how you find your people, I
yeah,
suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's great.
So how old is the company?
We've incorporated a little over a year ago. The invention's been percolating in the background for 3 years, you know, probably 4 years.
How mature would you say your solution or capability is?
So I would give it a self-assessed TRL, like 4 to 5. So
okay.
we're in the middle of beta testing with some private sector customers. And I've got some good conversations going on to beta test with like some of the NavalX industry connecting, what are they called? TechBridge. Mm. And then talking to DARPA. So there's various places that we can do some testing in the military intelligence context. But essentially, it is the same product for everybody because it kind of slots in at a level that's not different for military than it is for commercial. So yeah, that's it. And then it's a function of just making sure we've caught all the bugs or anything and then going through the process of getting the certifications required to just plug in. I always like to highlight that it's kind of like imagine a shim that you can slot in without replacing anything.
Right.
Like there's a place where it goes and it's the only thing that it is replacing is open source. Yeah. So, you know, we don't pose a threat to any existing, you know, giant systems because we're not building a system. We're just enabling the ones that exist and the ones that are in plans and then enabling them to talk to each other by opening a bottleneck that had prevented that in the first place.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to see how that plays out.
Yeah.
So you, unlike a lot of people I talk to who say they experience or moment where they saw a gap and they said, you know what, like, I think I know a person or a way to solve the gap, and they didn't know what they were getting themselves into. And so it was very much experiential learning and trying to maneuver and navigate bureaucracy and some of the things that it sounds like you have experience with, though. You worked at AAL and you were talking about like understanding the whole acquisition ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So how are you thinking about your product development strategy, given you have some experience inside the government and DoD in particular?
Yeah. So, I have so many thoughts on this. So, you know, just, you know,
you can squirrel.
Let me know
you
when
you have
to
permission.
Stop, right?
Yeah.
So I see a very clear 3-step strategy that unfortunately, in the way that the terminology seems not to include the second part, but it must in order to succeed. So first step of the strategy, if you want to be a dual-use company, is to go and get that non-dilutive funding, right? CyberSitter is great, but you're going to do phase 1, you're going to do phase 2. But meanwhile, you need to be doing step 2 of your own strategy, which is commercialization that needs to just be completely separate and more important, right? Because that's where you actually build your business. Then, you know, meanwhile, that CyberSitter is percolating in the background. It's influencing requirements. It's letting people on the inside, in the research labs, in the requirements writing and futures of each of the services know, hey, there's a capability out there that you might want to build into your expectations of what the thing you're asking for is going to look like. But that has to happen in the background for a couple of years before they actually give you what is step 3, procurement dollars, right? So a lot of startup founders and even just a lot of people just who don't have experience in this field have no idea that CBER phase one and phase two doesn't lead to phase three in any intrinsic way. Like, you have to do a lot of work, and also you need to be taking care of your business, you know, because it can't depend on that, right? So that's the big picture of, you know, I deeply care about getting this into DOD, intelligence communities, government, critical infrastructure. But also I know that I have to focus on the health of the company in a commercial sense in the meantime, otherwise we won't get there.
Right.
The other thing I'll say, and this is I say it with so much love, DOD and intelligence and, you know, the federal government, I think, has retained the sense that they are going to be a company's most important customer, and that they are the locus of emerging technologies,
right,
far beyond that being the case. And it's not to say that emerging technologies are not coming out of the labs and are not, you know, it's not to say that. It's simply to say that the balance has shifted in terms of even just investment R&D dollars, but also in terms of, you know, a certain American dynamism into the startup and private sector. And so the power relationship naturally shifts, such that I think that there's a lot of emphasis from DOD on teaching startups how to work with DOD when, you know, from
That's
the startups,
yeah,
from the startup's point of view, it's not just a barrier. It's like, why would I spend my time doing that when you're going to be my most fickle customer, right? why would I learn how to work with you? You should learn how to work with me, because I'm, you know, a lot of startups get really bogged down in trying to work with DOD, and then that kills them, right? So what I would just like to see from DOD is adaptation rather than teaching, an emphasis on adaptation and on learning, because the onus really is on DOD to make it an attractive opportunity. I absolutely understand there's a lot of reasons why that's difficult. I just, you know, it's a reality that needs to be factored in, you know? Like, if you want the best tech, you need to make yourself attractive as a customer, and that's... you know, for me, I'm going to try hard regardless, but there's just a lot of people in my field are like, yeah, I could get really bogged down there, and I'm just going to wait for them to like figure out that I'm here and reach out. And I'm like, okay, hopefully it'll do that.
Right? What's an example of something that would make it more attractive? Like, if we did more of something or less of something?
Yeah. So, I like the idea. So, clear language broadcasted in communities that startup founders and you know already exist in, right? So, for example, you know, people who aren't already involved in DOD don't know what effects means. They don't know what fires means. Like, there's a lot of words that will go right over somebody's head, even though they have a technology that would contribute to the effect that you're looking for, right? But they don't know that you're asking for it.
I see.
So even myself, I spend a lot of time in putting together my Air Force CBER Sitter Phase 1, really combing through like technology interest area documents, you know, language from people talking at conferences and of course RFIs and RFPs. I know what that language means.
Right.
I live in that world. And it's still kind of hard to be sure that what they're asking for is what we have, in the sense that I can quote it and explain the connection. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
I know from my background that, like, you know, when they say distributed maritime operations, for example, which is just an example at the front of my mind, I know that what they need is X, Y, and Z in terms of the network and compute infrastructure, but it's not really spelled out in that.
Yeah,
like, it's described in terms of like how, you know, how you're going to mass fires with different platforms, and, you know, so if there were a really serious effort to translate from like kind of mil speak of the requirement that they have or the technology interest area they have into, we're trying to get this to plug into that. Like, do you have a way to do that, right?
Mm-hmm.
It may not look like what we expected. Or, you know, we need to detect a certain thing, and it might look like this, it might look like that, and the the problem is we're not sure whether it'll look like this or that. And so help us figure out whether it'll look like this or that, right? Really plain language, because then somebody who's working on something for an entirely different field can map their capability onto what you're asking for.
Are use cases helpful in that scenario? That's something, or my team's adopted that as a best practice, but now I'm wondering, is that even enough based on what you're saying? Because are we being too broad or unclear about what the actual gap is?
I think it's a really big step in the right direction. Okay. I mean, there's just always room for improvement, right? I think that you guys are probably doing some of the best job among all of the different areas that I've looked at. Like, it's very clear to me that, of course, I need to go talk to CDAO, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you guys are kind of, I would say you're doing a pretty good job.
We need to do a great job, though. So, like, even though, like, I mean, I'm hearing, like, okay, there's like a low bar and we're like above this low bar. I'm like, no, like, yes. We need to, okay, we're going to press the gas a little bit. So I'm hearing you there. But
I don't have a specific critique of you guys to share on the, you know,
but I'm also happy to try later. I'm also trying to share, like, for anyone on the government side listening, because one thing that I've found in the acquisition community is speaking in problem statements versus requirements is difficult. Or when I say it's difficult, it's not practiced.
Yeah, it's not a strengthened muscle.
Yeah, already. Exactly. Yeah.
It's like, not a habit.
Yeah. So some people it is because their mission dictated they do something different. Our team is kind of a consequence of that. Like when we started at the JAIC, the Joint Artificial Intelligence Center, what are AI requiring? Like there were no, like we couldn't start there. So, yeah. So it was very natural for us to go toward, well, let's open up the aperture, do that. But that's, again, us trying to get other people to start to get those reps in can be, depending on people's environments, risk tolerances, it's just different, and that creates its own challenges. So what would you like, can you talk about how that helps you in your seat? If you can speak, and you already mentioned, like, language is important, how we're messaging things. Like, if you can take it like a layer deeper, though, what is meaningful or impactful to you on how we are asking for you to submit solutions or against requirements?
Yeah. So, and a note on, I think part of the clear language challenge is difficult because when you're speaking in terms of requirements, that's a very authoritative, like, we've got it handled. We're the United States, you know, like, we have everything we need. But if you want to work with us, we require X, Y, and Z, right? Saying that you don't know how to do something and you need help is a much more vulnerable, you know, I mean, that's kind of
state.
Is it the message we want to send, right? Like, do we want to say the U.S. government doesn't know how to plug these two things together, right? So there's a tightrope to walk there. I just think we're not quite properly balanced on it at this point. And clear language would be useful. So I'm going to throw out a scenario that sounds a little ridiculous from my perspective because I know how
Let's go.
What gets in the way.
Yeah.
But what would make sense to the community of kind of private sector startup, you know, VC people who aren't necessarily already involved with dual use and DoD would be an avenue of streamlined, like, front door that's not just a front door to a small organization or an innovation outfit, right? But like a front door that's kind of, you know, Cyber sort of does this, but where you funnel yourself into certain categories and then you know that somebody who's an expert in your field will actually take a look at what you're submitting to. And where it's very clear how the best ideas that come through there get funded. Mm. Have each of those characteristics is present in various locations in the innovation ecosystem, but they don't seem to quite be present in the same process, right? Because CyberSitter is great, but also I know that I need to design a deck that somebody's going to look at for maybe 3 minutes, right? And they're not going to be an expert. in that field. And I have something that's pretty darn technical, and it's kind of hard to explain why it matters so much. So I took the route of essentially going and getting like a bunch of retired three stars and like a bunch of commercial people and a bunch of VCs to just give me quotations that I've talked to them for an hour or two, and they understand what we're doing. And so they're like, okay, I see that this makes sense. So we just have pages of quotations from people because I know that our actual stuff is not going to necessarily make an impact on the reviewer because there's no reason they would be an expert in what we're talking about. So could there be something kind of like SIBR-SITR, but that gets funneled to whoever is the expert across any of the services, right? They're out there. It can't be that there's not enough time among, you know, like that's the combination of things that I would like to see. And then for there to be a pot of money that can't get diverted anywhere else that is just for the best stuff that comes in that way, right? I know it sounds a little fanciful, but that's what would make sense to me. And it shouldn't be too hard, right?
Yeah, I think you're drawing a lens to how do you take this into action?
Yeah.
And which is where we started.
Do something.
So, I mean, so if I were problem solving with you right now, yeah. If we could do this on the fly, so I would set up a commercial solutions opening for this construct, because that opens up the aperture similar to, so you know, R&D, broad agency announcement procedures is already doing this in the R&D space for the most part. That's kind of their normal way of doing business. They have these focus areas, topics of interest. Mm-hmm. They don't really know what they're looking for, but they have experts who can say there is merit to this proposal or this idea, and we're going to research it.
Yeah,
it's kind of the same thing on the product side. Okay. So the commercial solutions opening gives you that same pathway or methodology, but you don't have to. You're not limited to basic and applied research. Mm-hmm. Anyone that'll listen, I've always told PEOs, PMs, everyone, every office should have a CSO.
Yeah,
the challenge is. What you said, how they may or may not have experts, though, to review what's coming through. I think there's some creative problem solving around that. Like, how can we resource share or get access to innovators? I do think that wouldn't be a long pull in the tent. It's not a deal breaker.
Because they exist. It's just a function of mapping them and knowing where to send something for review.
But if and you could even do it from an end user perspective, get end users to look at it and say, do you think this would impact your life? Yeah. You know, that could be a criteria. And then with the PEOs owning and driving that, they commit the money. Mm-hmm. And so there's a more clear path, to your point, than a SIBR-SITR pathway.
Yeah.
So like I don't think that's not a pie in the sky.
It shouldn't be too hard, but
I mean, that's a very real thing, construct that can happen.
Yeah.
That was great.
Thank you. I mean, I I'll say another thing, which is that I think that probably versions of this exist. It's just that I don't know which among the 450 innovation resources it is, right? Yeah. Like, where should I here? So here's another, just I'll throw this out there. I think that there is I understand why it is decentralized. That makes sense. There's all sorts of innovation centers, and they all kind of seem to do everything, and you have to figure out what they really do, right? And they operate at different TRLs and different colors of money and et cetera, use case interest areas. I think that a casualty of all of that diversity is a learned helplessness on the part of people who are trying to make use of it, because it is often enough you think it's what you can actually get from one of those institutions is very different from what it seems like you're going to be able to at the beginning, because they're all trying to do a lot, right? And they've got ambitions.
They don't believe like it's their job to, or that they have any ownership in that like innovation space. Is that what you mean?
By they, you mean like startup people or?
No. Oh, I was thinking on the government side. There's a learned helplessness.
Industry. Both.
Okay.
In a nutshell, I think that the complexity and counterintuitiveness and thinking you found something and then realizing there's some bureaucratic reason why you can't use it. I think that whole the complexity of that, like, it's too much for a human brain to handle. And I think it teaches people to give up before they've found the place that will actually be helpful, right? Mm. I wrote a memo on this for T3, Lieutenant General Todd, who was he's retired now, but he was the commanding officer of Army Futures Command when I worked here. And it just laid out, like, I looked for all the money that we're supposed to be able to access, right? Like as in, when you go to Congress and ask for transition money, they point to these funds and say, why aren't you using these? Once you use these, we'll give you more. So I went and followed up on them, and I spent like 3 months researching the existence and the rules and the norms and the offices behind these resources. And most of them are not actually usable for one reason or another. And one office actually stood out as being very available and friendly, and they picked up the phone and they seemed to really have money and it was actually available. And that was John Lazar at Innovation and Modernization and DOD. So just shout out to, he's running a really cool, program. But like, that one isn't enough to support, you know, the expectations people have going in that they're going to be able to use this long list of funds and resources, right? And I think that people learn, I can't do it, when the truth of it is, it wasn't really that possible to begin with. So I think there's a lot that's not getting done because people are discouraged, right? Mm. And then they kind of retreat into, okay, fine, I'll just stamp papers, right? They become more checkers than doers because they've tried to do, and it was simply too complicated. And, you know, I think that there's just sort of there's a lot of good things about the way that we've constructed our modernization ecosystem, but that's a casualty of kind of the, I think that innovative people often find themselves discouraged before they find the answer, even though it may be out there, right?
Yeah, there's maybe too many layers and it seems impossible to get there.
Yeah. And it's a lot of, it takes heroics to find the right money, the right contract, the right end user, the right MOU, the right, you know.
Yeah, right money. Yeah. Well, let's not end on a sour note.
Yeah, sure.
what are you encouraged by right now in terms of, so that's a reality,
yeah.
But stuff still has to get done.
Yeah.
So anything out there that you think is encouraging for startups like yourself to keep going? Don't give up.
Oh my God. So this whole weekend at Capital Factory and South by Southwest, right? So I come here each year to just get re-energized because so many of the people who are part of the solution are here and reminding each other that what we're doing is actually pushing the ball forward. So I see a company like Second Front Systems, right? I'm a big fan. They have supported me in so many ways. And I think that what they do for modernization is really important. You see a company like Mobilize Vision, right? I've been watching them for a couple of years. Yeah. And at the beginning, I was like, oh, yeah, we need that. Like, that'll be really good. And then, you know, each year I see them incorporating more services. Now I think they've got them all and they're working on adoption and they're working on, you know, where do they belong in, you know, who owns the contract with them. But like, those are good problems to have because their product is something that brings it all together. Their product is something that lets people in the Air Force know that the Navy's found something cool, right? And that's the solution. It is people talking to each other. It is people, I mean, picking up the phone and calling instead of feeling like they shouldn't.
So to your point, just this isn't a brag so much as it is like this, you're not just saying these things. So Mobilize Vision, last year at South by Southwest, what has happened in the last year for them, I think, started with a conversation at South by Southwest between some people here, and they were having trouble with, I think, getting the Army to kind of come to the table and try out what they had going on. And they've started a pilot, I don't know how big the pilot is, but like, It all happened again because I was there. Like I just happened to know this. So that is, I think there's some truth in what you're saying. It's not just a hey, go to conferences and meet people kind of thing you're saying. Like there's some of the humans that want to create change are in these spaces and they're there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what overcomes that helplessness that I was talking about. Like, you know, we recognize it, and then we're also figuring out how to make those connections. And I think that's also what gets at the kinds of solutions we were talking about earlier. That one area that you, you know, the one innovation hub that you put some time into connecting with, they may not have the expert, right? But the expert is out there in the government. Like, there's so many great experts in, you know, the other innovation hubs, right? And so it really takes events like this. It takes, you know, people like yourself.
It's like the honeypot. Like.
Yeah, exactly. it's a synergy, you know, generator. And I think that this really is kind of what overcomes it, because you have representatives from all of these different entities and organizations. And, you know, like, now after this weekend, now I know where I'm going to go to do some testing and validation in a phase two. And I know who the MOU writer is going to be, and I know who the end user is going to be, and I know where the money's going to come from. And it's because, you know, the most innovative people from all of the organizations came here and just, like, you know, put our brains together.
So let's go. Yeah. Okay. So my new favorite way to end the podcast is to ask a super serious, hard question. Ready? Mm-hmm. Would you dip your grilled cheese in hot chocolate?
Oh my. Under what circumstances? I don't currently do so. I would do it once.
Once?
I'll try.
You're skeptical though, because you said I would try it once, but may not be a thing I would be into. Sounds like.
Okay, here's a question. What kind of cheese is on the grilled cheese? Because if it's cheddar,
dealer's choice.
Less interesting, but I could imagine some interesting like brie, you know,
like a grilled. The nuances to how people answer this question is amazing. The fact that you're like, what kind of cheese is on there actually makes a difference. Never thought of that.
Definitely makes a difference. I would dip a grilled cheese with brie into hot chocolate, or maybe or some other kind of nice creamy, you know, fancy French cheese.
Okay.
Sharp cheddar cheese in hot chocolate, probably that would probably be a one-time experience. But I'm going to go try it now.
Well, okay, here's
what prompts you to ask.
So it's a Midwest. I learned that this is a Midwest staple, a thing that they do, and I had never heard of it, and I thought I was crazy because I was the only person who never heard of this. But now I ask everyone, no one's heard of this.
No one's heard of it.
So it's not just me. Midwest people are just, you know.
So have you dipped grilled cheese in hot chocolate?
I have not partake yet, but so a new one I learned today was, would you dip your peanut butter and jelly in chili?
In like bean chili?
Sure, yeah. Okay. Bean chili.
Probably a one-time experience as well, but
you would be open to it.
Yeah, I'll be open to it.
You would be open to it.
I'm going to do both of them, and I will reach out and let you know.
Both are Midwest things, and that I'm learning about. The more I ask people this,
the more you learn.
Apparently, for school children, uncrustable, mm-hmm. That's what's called. Dipped in chili is kind of a thing.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I don't know if it's still a thing.
Very weird little kid who loved broccoli. But I would dip it in ketchup, and everyone in the room goes, "Whoa!"
Yeah, that's.
But for some reason, that was like the thing.
Your jam?
I've kind of grown out of it, but like
raw or cooked broccoli.
Cooked. Yeah, okay. I mean, raw broccoli
still
goes in ranch.
Ketchup. Broccoli goes in ranch.
But yeah, no. There's for some reason that emerged as something I wanted as a kid, and still wouldn't say no to it. It's very weird. Oh. We like different things, don't we?
Well, I mean, I can't thank you enough.
Thank you.
Appreciate you giving me some time, sharing your experience with everybody.
I appreciate that you do the podcast. I think it brings a lot of good knowledge into the space.
Yes.
And yeah.
Awesome. Well, I hope you're going to get some stuff done, right?
I'm going to get some stuff done.
I want to see some great things.
All right.
From Kachai.
Check back in. Yeah.
Kachai?
Kachai.
I got it.
Yeah. Thanks so much for bringing me on.
Yeah. Take care.